on a bill that would cut federal funding for public broadcasting by 45%. This cut would cost WILL Radio as much as $183,000. WILL Television would be cut even more. Many of you have called your congressmen and senators to let them know how much you support public broadcasting. If you haven't yet done so, there's still time. It's very important that they hear what you think about cuts to WILL's federal funding. You'll find the phone numbers of your members of Congress on our website, will.uiuc.edu, or call us at 217-333-1070. Thank you.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In this hour of Focus, we will be talking once again about energy. We decided that one of the things that we wanted to do this summer was to spend some time talking about energy and energy policy. And one of the things that we wanted to focus on was alternatives to fossil fuels. And we have talked so far about solar power. We're talking about doing some things on biomass and other sorts of energy. And in this part of Focus 580, we will be talking about wind energy, which is the fastest growing electricity generating technology now in the world. Over the past decade, global installations of wind energy systems have grown at least 10 times. And here in the United States, wind energy installations have tripled in 5 years. We'll be talking a little bit about the potential for this technology in this hour of Focus 580 with Robert Thresher. He currently serves as director of the National Wind Technology Division of the National Renewable Energy Lab, and that's based in Golden, Colorado. He's worked as program manager for the U.S. Department of Energy in Washington, D.C., and then he spent 4 years as assistant professor of mechanical engineering at Oregon State University and was the acting director of the Energy Research and Development Institute. He is talking with us this morning by telephone, and as we talk, of course, questions are welcome. I know he will do his best to give you an answer. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, if you'd like to call in, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us. If you're listening around Illinois and Indiana over the air, or if you're listening on the internet anywhere in the United States, you may use the toll-free line. That is 800-222-9455. So again, 333-WILL, if that makes it any easier, 333-WILL, and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Dr. Thresher, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us today. We certainly appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Maybe just as a general question to start off with, if you look at the mix of energy sources now in the United States, you look at what comes from fossil fuels, what comes from, and I guess particularly I'm thinking about electricity generation, what comes from nuclear, what comes from burning coal, what comes from renewables. If you sit the renewables next to the fossil fuels, what percentage of the mix are, if you look at all of the renewables, what percentage is that?
Well, it depends a little bit on how you do the bookkeeping. If you include the hydropower, that is the dams and river system, that's over 4% of the electrical generation. Wind energy, which is the next biggest renewable in the electric generation area, is less than 0.5% of our energy comes from wind. Mm-hmm. Wind is, and the renewables, typically they classify those as the new renewables, and hydropower has been around for quite a while.
So when you look at so far, the contribution of wind is small, but I do understand that there has been significant increase in the amount of wind generation that we now have.
That's correct. In this country, we've got around almost 7,000 megawatts of wind energy, which is not a lot, but it is around 10 years ago, 15 years ago, there were more like 1,500 megawatts. So we've gone up dramatically. It's been growing at 20 to 25% per year over the last 5 years or so. Worldwide, it is also growing dramatically. Worldwide, There's over 47,000, getting close to 50,000 megawatts of wind installed worldwide. Europe is probably the leader in installing new wind systems. Germany, Spain, Denmark, the UK or Britain, and they're pretty much the leaders. The Netherlands, and they're the desire is to cap the amount of carbon emissions. So to reduce carbon emissions, if they go to wind, which produces almost none, except during the manufacturing of the equipment. So during the electricity generation, there's no carbon emitted, and that's been a goal under the Kyoto Accord, and Europe has bought into that and is moving to put in place alternate sources of generation that don't count on burning fossil fuels.
So we can say that while the contribution to date of wind energy to the total energy mix is small, we can also say that here in the United States, at least, we can also say that it is growing, it is increasing. What's anybody's guess about what the potential would be for wind? That is, what do you think an optimistic sort of estimate would be about how much energy it could provide?
Well, there's a lot of arguments about that, but let me look at just the brute resource potential. In other words, do we have a lot of windy regions in the country? And the answer is an emphatic yes, just in terms of areas with wind that's sufficiently high, over average wind speed over the year, that it would warrant the installation of wind generators. We have vast areas of the country that would qualify for wind installations. In fact, just in terms of windy land area, there's enough out there to easily supply just the brute amount of electrical energy we would need. Now, it won't come at the right time or at the right place, but we could supply the entire nation's electrical needs using wind energy. And it's we could also, if we looked offshore, because off the coasts there's tremendous amounts of wind also, so there's plenty of wind to supply the electrical needs of the country at least twice over. So we're very rich in terms of wind energy.
So I was just going to say, if you ask the question where are the biggest technical challenges, then it sounds as if it's not so much in constructing the turbines, the things that the windmills essentially that we sort of know how to do that. Maybe the bigger challenge then how it is that you get the energy that you produce from the place where the wind farm is to the place that it's needed.
That's actually one of the challenges, but. If you look back, the reason that let me talk about the technology challenges sort of in general. The first one is that the price that you pay for wind energy is still higher than you would pay for the energy coming from a coal plant. So wind is still more expensive than coal. It's only been in the last 2 years that wind has become cheaper than natural gas. As the price of natural gas rose over the last few years, then wind has become more competitive. In addition, the price of wind has gone down pretty dramatically over the last several years, but going even further back, wind in 1980, when it was first installed in commercial quantities in California, cost something like 40 cents a kilowatt hour, whereas now it's more like 4 cents a kilowatt hour. And so when the price of natural gas is high, then wind can compete successfully with natural gas. But it still has a technology challenge to get cheaper than coal. And that's one challenge. The next challenge is, you're absolutely right, the places that the wind blows the hardest are not where the load centers are. And North and South Dakota have vast amounts of wind energy, Wyoming, Montana, all the way down to Texas. But that's not the load center. So the load centers are are quite removed from that. Chicago, in the Midwest, Minneapolis, on the coast. 50% of our loads are on the two coasts. So having the transmission to be able to get that out of the Midwest to where you need it is indeed a challenge. And that adds, in fact, to the price you'd pay for the wind energy. The further you have to ship it, the more it would cost.
We have a caller here to bring into the conversation. I want to do that, and perhaps also I should just very quickly reintroduce our guest for this hour of Focus 580. We're talking with Robert Thresher. He is the director of the National Wind Technology Division of the National Renewable Energy Laboratory. That's based in Golden, Colorado. We're talking about wind energy, the potential of using wind to generate electricity and have that be part of the mix of energy here in the United States. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. We have a caller here in Atlanta, Illinois, on our toll free line, line 4. Hello.
Good morning, gentlemen. Mm-hmm. Interesting conversation, and thank you for taking my call. I've got three quick questions. I've been seriously considering installing a wind generator at my house from Southwest Wind Power. It's about a 1K generator. It costs, with the tower and everything, about $7,000. And in my case, I wasn't going to use batteries. I was just going to feed that back into the system to help deduct my bill. So I want to ask you what you think about doing that. And the other next question is, I live right on the edge of a nature preserve, and one of the main features of the nature preserve is the bird habitat. If I start chopping up birds with the wind generator, my wife's going to divorce me for sure. So I don't want to do that. I wonder if that possibility. And the third question is that I'm a backup meter reader for Corn Belt Electric Company, which is a co-op that serves the rural areas of central Illinois. And traveling around to over 100 sites here meeting the reader, it looks to me like every site has at least some possibility because of its remoteness here in central Illinois to run a wind generator. Would it be viable for Corn Belt to, through the bill of subtracting the amount of energy produced from your bill to in the aspect of paying for these wind generators, would a 1,000K wind generator at 100 sites help contribute to their power in an economical, feasible way? And I'll shut up.
First of all, I applaud your efforts to use wind at your house, and I know there are a lot of people in windy areas that are doing that. We have a couple of those Southwest Wind Power machines running here at the site, and they seem to be very, very reliable machines. The whether you can pay back the cost of the wind turbine or not depends on what the rate you're paying for electricity, because I think you're doing what they call net metering, and basically when the wind's blowing, then you're subtracting from your electric use, and you just pay the net bill to the utility company. And it depends on your utility rate and how much wind you have at the exact location. And the wind actually varies quite dramatically from site to site. Even a 1 mile per hour difference can significantly change the energy capture. The kinetic energy in the wind is a cubic function of the actual wind speed. So very small, a 10% change in wind speed is about a 30% difference in the kinetic energy in the wind. So small differences make a big difference. So installing your machine, try and install it in the most open location where it's not blocked by trees and the prevailing wind direction and isn't blocked by the house. And also that'll help the avian issue because if the birds can see it, they'll try to avoid it. And so keeping it clearly visible and out of places that a lot of birds tend to congregate, and don't locate the bird feeder near the wind turbine would be the other thing, to draw them in. So typically, the area of a small turbine is so small that you have a very low probability of birds flying into it if you keep it out in the open where the birds won't tend to congregate.
Very interesting, though. So what about the question of Corn Belt in general? Would it be economically feasible for them if if the wind was determined. As a matter of fact, they're doing a site study for some other wind-generating system. I just saw them put up the tower the other day with the mechanisms on it for putting a large wind farm near here. So there is...
Typically, if you've got a large wind farm being located near you, you probably get something on the order of 13 miles per hour measured 10 meters above the ground, something in that order. We'd call it a class 4 wind site. And that gives you a pretty good wind resource. So you'd have to go through the numbers, and there are some ways you could calculate that, but... usually, you don't make a lot of money on it. If you break even, you're really doing well. But if a lot of people did do that, it is feasible, and it does reduce the load to the utility. So it does contribute. It's what we would call distributed generation, and it's a generation source that's distributed, and when the wind blows, it helps reduce the load to the utility.
Okay. Well, right now, Corn Belt buys most of electricity, so our rates on proportional to other rates in the state are pretty extremely high. So I was thinking of trying to get some kind of presentation and go talking to them about it. There might be some possibility that could be of interest with a relatively small investment. $7,000 for a site isn't extremely expensive.
No, that's not. That's not terribly expensive at all.
How does the 1K stack up per household? Say if you had in just my meter district here.
Southwest Wind Power picked that size because that is a typical bill in the with a reasonable wind resource. That size would generate. On the basis of a year, about the amount of energy you would consume. So they tried to pick that kind of for the average house. I think it's about 1,000 kilowatt hours a month is what the average house would use. So that machine was sized to sort of provide about the right amount for an average size residence. So if you have a bigger residence, you could buy two,
mm-hmm.
And, but you need to have the acreage and the space to put it in, and you need to be a little bit remote because if you're in a residential neighborhood, some of your neighbors might not appreciate the wind turbine. In very high wind conditions, they can get a little noisy.
Yeah, when they try to turn out of the wind, the way I understand that they actually turn out of the wind a little bit, and that causes some buffeting of the propeller and stuff where they do make some noise at that time.
Right, so you need to be prepared that they are going to make a little noise, and in high winds, and you need to have the space to put them in so that they're not blocked by houses or trees and things like that. So you need to have a little bit of open space to put them in. That typically means you need something on the order of an acre or so to have enough space. It all depends on your situation. But
well, all these subscribers to Corn Belt are out in the middle of cornfields, these 100 subscribers, so there's virtually nothing blocking any of them, and they're all, you know, at least a quarter of a mile from each other, or at least an eighth of a mile, so that would be good. So if I made this proposal to Corn Belt that they do this, would it be cost-effective for them to do it, to, say, have 100 sites of wind generators running around, you know, small ones in this area, which is rather remote, and would that help them?
I think that right now it's more of the environmentally conscious that would do this. According to our numbers, sort of the average cost for a small turbine is the cost of electricity is close to 10 cents a kilowatt hour when you, in spite of the low cost of that turbine. You add it up, and it ends up being fairly expensive electricity. So the best you can do is kind of hope to break even on it. It's not going to probably make you a lot of money or help the utility a tremendous amount. So it's still a bit on the the R&D side in terms of, or the entrepreneur who wants to, who's very conscious about the environment, wants to avoid some emissions, and supply a little of his energy. It's not going to be a money maker at this point.
Well, I thank you very much, and that was most helpful. Thank you.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. Just to make sure that I get this straight, we were talking earlier about the fact that wind energy now just only recently has become cheaper than natural gas. It's still more expensive than coal, and that you're looking about at about, if you were talking about a large array of turbines.
That's a large wind farm where you have very large machines. And they're put in such a way to basically to make money.
Right.
And the difference is it's all about the rotor size. The small machines that are for residential units, the money-making part of the machine is the rotor. And that ends up being fairly small. They're also smaller machines that are closer to the ground, and so they're not in as energetic air. The higher you can get them up, the better off you are. The problem with the residential units is a lot of the zoning restrictions require fairly short towers, like 30 feet. You're just not far enough up to get into the high-energy air. And you also have, with a small rotor diameter, the tower cost and the infrastructure cost, the fixed costs, the power converter and whatnot, tend to be fairly large compared to the rest of the cost. So the cost per kilowatt hour turns out to be more in the 10 cents a kilowatt hour range than in the 4 cents a kilowatt hour range.
And most of that is hardware cost, essentially, the cost of buying it and putting it up.
Yes, basically it's all upfront cost in that it comes in the purchase price, and then you use the energy stream to basically to sell as electricity to pay it off over a period of time. So it's like it's like buying a house. Only you buy a wind turbine, you put out a loan, and then the energy that you generate, you sell, and you pay off your loan. So when you do the calculations, it turns out that typically the small wind turbine is around the order of 10 cents a kilowatt hour. Now, if you've got a little better wind regime, as I said before, that's dramatically different if the wind speed is fairly high. So if you're in a high wind resource area, you do much better. Typically, the smaller machines are in near houses. People don't like to live in really, really windy areas. So it'd be unusual to have a very high wind speed where people enjoyed living.
All right, let's talk with somebody else. We have someone next up in Champaign on our line number one. Hello.
Yes, interesting. Could you discuss storage advances in storing electricity and like super cool transmission that would allow areas with wind to send power to big cities? And also here during very hot weather, sometimes as a public service announcement, it says try to use less electricity, but the news says in Europe they have these signals somehow they send, and it just shuts off your air conditioner. Do we have that here yet?
That's called demand control where you turn the loads off, and that's a control. And you need a two-way system where you have certain loads that, for example, your water heater, you might go in and turn that off. If the utility had control of that, they could turn that off during very high peak demand times, middle of the afternoon in the hot summer, and they could turn that off so that they could run more air conditioners. And that would help that part. Let me see. Can you give me the other part of your question again?
Well, the caller was asking, and we've kind of touched on this a little bit, about transmission and storage, particularly
storage.
Because here, obviously, the problem is, you know, you need the wind may not necessarily be blowing at the time that you need the energy. And so then the issue is, well, do we have some really good way that we can store the energy when the wind is blowing and then at some later point use it?
Storage has been a real sticky issue. I've been working in wind and in energy in general for 30 years since the first oil embargo. And the wind technology has progressed dramatically, as indicated by the costs I described earlier, dropping from 40 cents to 4 cents over the past 20 years, 25 years. But storage has not seen the dramatic technology improvements. The batteries are not terribly cost-effective. We are getting better and better batteries for running computers and things like that for small loads. Large amounts of storage to run a house or for storage for transportation systems, for example, for an electric car, those just have not progressed as fast. They're heavy. They're fairly expensive. So storing bulk power is very difficult. The only effective means, or cost-effective means today, is probably hydropower. The storage that we try to take advantage of with wind systems, because they're intermittent, they only produce when the wind blows, which you'd like to do is have on your same grid or same electrical system some capability to store water while the wind was blowing, and then when the wind wasn't blowing, to use the water. And that's probably the most effective and cost-effective storage at this point in time. Other than that, there's the batteries, which are local storage. There are some systems that you can use for small amounts of power. There are some developing technologies. One is compressed air storage, and typically that's used to compress air in a salt dome or underground or in some kind of a vessel, and then use that compressed air to assist a gas turbine to produce electricity. That's called compressed air energy storage. Typically, it's called CAES. After batteries, there's making hydrogen, and I'm going kind of from the least expensive to the most expensive. So the technology is just not cost-effective for bulk storage, except for the hydropower at this point. So it has not progressed technically as far as some of the generation technologies like solar and wind.
The other issue, and again, it's something that we've talked about, deals with the basic problem that the windiest places might be a long way away from the places where the greatest demand for the energy is, so that you have to get it from the one place to the other. And is there anything that what's current state of the art, or what are people thinking about in terms of perhaps exotic technologies as a way of improving the efficiency of the transmission from where it's produced to where the people are who want it?
Well, the exotic technology, of course, is to improve the efficiency by using superconducting materials. And there's a lot of research going into how to do that. And that covers the ability for what they call high-temperature superconductive materials. Basically, can go into generators and transmission systems. And what you'd like to do is be able to make wire. And right now they're having trouble making the wire, and then you have to cool it. But eventually the hope is to be able to develop some wires that had much less resistance, and that would greatly improve the efficiency of transmitting the power. Another technology is just some very simple incremental improvements would be things people are looking at, putting in carbon fibers to either wrap or as part of the conductor bundle to support the electric wire. What tends to happen is as the conductor heats under high load, it sags, and that sags it into trees and causes shorts. So if you put the carbon in there, it helps support the structural load or carry the weight of the copper conductor, and you can run it much hotter under high load conditions. So there's people looking at some incremental technologies so that you can do reconductoring put in new wires on the same towers, but up the capacity. And that's probably a near-term solution compared to the more exotic high-temperature superconductors.
Mm-hmm. We are a little bit past the midpoint here. I have another caller we'll get right to in just a second. But for the benefit of anybody who might have tuned in recently here, I want to introduce again our guest. Robert Thresher is a mechanical engineer by his academic training. He worked as a program manager for the U.S. Department of Energy in Washington. He spent 4 years as assistant professor of mechanical engineering at Oregon State University, was the acting director of the Energy Research and Development Institute, and currently he serves as the director of the National Wind Technology Division of the National Renewable Energy Laboratory in Golden, Colorado. And we're talking about wind energy in this hour of the show. And questions are welcome. 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. And we next will talk with someone up in northern Illinois on our toll-free line. Line 4. Hello.
Yeah, I'm at the center of a 250 tower 1.5 project, and we're concerned that in 20 years all these towers become obsolete and we're stuck with a bunch of steel and concrete in the middle of a cornfield. What's that possibility?
Actually, the experience in California is that what's happening there is they're repowering.
Right.
That once the wind site, you put in, let's say, a technology today for a wind turbine might be 1.5 megawatts, is I'm assuming what you're talking about.
Yeah, right, 1.5. And they're talking about maybe in 2 to 3 years go to a 3-meg tower. Is that feasible?
Yeah, well, what would happen is they'll probably take out the old towers and turbines and scrap them, but they wouldn't. They would replace those, because once you develop the wind site, you have a certain capability to run power in and out, and probably a substation, and it's a proven wind site, so you would go back and then put in the newer technology, which typically has been to put in fewer larger turbines and replace the older, smaller turbines. The way that they've achieved better economy is to scale the turbines to larger and larger sizes, as we understood how to the technology enough to be able to build very large wind turbines.
Okay.
And so the likely that they would be replaced with a new generation that would be more efficient, quieter, and probably larger.
Okay. What about, do fossil fuel plants have to be running on standby when the wind dies down? Are we really saving that much power?
Actually, you do save power. But you're absolutely correct. There needs to be a plant that is on standby or idle to pick up the load if the wind goes down. And that has a small cost associated with it to continue to do that. But the carbon emissions are low and the fuel use is minimal for that situation, because you're not producing power. You're sort of on spinning reserve. So you do need a certain amount of spinning reserve to help alleviate the problems of bringing plants up and down. A lot of the wind people, the people that are running the wind plants, have gone to forecasting the wind so that they can forecast a day ahead or 2 days ahead kind of what the wind resource is going to be. And then they can basically tell the utility dispatcher, give him a little information on how to better forecast what units to bring on, whether there's going to be a little bit of wind or a lot of wind. It isn't perfect, but it certainly helps the situation in terms of having the right amount of reserve ready for whatever the wind output's going to be.
Okay, well, that seems to be the biggest news in the neighborhood is 250 towers. So
that sounds like a big plant.
Yeah, there are three companies trying to compete for options for the same land. So right now we're trying to make decisions on which company would be the best long-term event.
Well, typically the local community I've been to several wind sites, particularly in Minnesota, where they've been very pleased over a period of time because of the increase to the tax base.
Yeah,
and then of course
about that.
To the people that have wind units, four or five wind units located on their farm or their land, they get a royalty payment, much like an oil having an oil well. You get paid a percentage of the money from the electricity sold. It typically amounts to $2,000 or $3,000 a year. So
I think they're talking almost $3,000 or $4,000 minimum. Now.
Okay, those are the bigger units.
Right.
And so it goes up with size. So typically, it's been very beneficial to the local economy in just direct payments and tax base, but it also does generate some longer term jobs You also think about it a little bit as the a balance of trade in that there's money that's not going to buy fuel someplace else, natural gas or something of that nature. So there is some economic benefit locally, although on the downside, you do have to put up with the visual appearance of the turbines, and that's bothered a lot of people, there's been... quite a little bit of discussion. Some people are very much against having wind plants in their area because of the visual appearance. They feel it's industrializing the countryside. And there are other folks that seem to like them. So it's somewhat a matter of taste.
What do you think about it? What would a fair setback from a residence be?
I don't know. There are typically setback rules and some rules of thumb, but typically I would say something on the order of 5 to 10 rotor diameters away. You shouldn't really notice much in the way of any sound. That people claim they're noisy, but they really just make a swishing sound. And once in a while you get a clunk or a generator sound. And it tends to be worst when the winds are low. Because the sound will carry better. When the winds are high, you tend to hear the wind, and it kind of masks the kind of white noise of the wind, masks the any swishing sound from the rotor.
But is a 1,500-foot setback be reasonable?
That sounds reasonable to me.
Okay. Well, the county, I don't think they've come up with anything yet, but they're trying to come up with some type of a setback because I think some of these other larger projects ran into trouble when they put them too close to the residents.
Yeah, you can. There are some. You do get a little bit of noise if they're very close to residences, and you can get some just the visual disturbance. It seems to bother some people. Other people seem to enjoy them. So I'm not sure. I could sort out who would like them and who wouldn't.
Well, I've been to them, and I don't think they look that bad, especially if you're getting paid for them. So.
Well, if you're getting paid for them, that seems to make it...
It's like raising hogs. The smell isn't so
doesn't
bad.
Bother you. I'm not sure I would have used that analogy, but I understand it.
Okay.
Well, thanks for the call.
All right, thank you.
Well, let's go on here to someone here in Champaign. That's our next caller, line one. Hello.
Hi. I live out in the country here near Champaign, and for a long time I've toyed with the idea of trying to figure out how to put wind power to use because it blows here about 365 days a year, I think. Is there any project to, like, have individual homeowners be able to have, like, a wind tower on their property that would be like solar where you could feed it back to the electric company if you had too much but you could use it yourself? Anything like that going on?
Well, there are some units for commercial sale. One of the earlier callers indicated that he had purchased the Southwest, or was considering purchasing a Southwest wind power machine, which is a 1 kilowatt machine, which is intended for residential use. And I think he said it cost $7,000 for that particular machine.
Ooh.
And so it's on the order of buying a car.
Yeah.
So it's not terribly cheap. The electricity is not all that cheap, but if you're really environmentally conscious and you want to pay part of your electricity bill and generate a little less carbon emissions and other emissions, then those are the folks that are buying them at this point. And the people that want to be, some people want to be self-sufficient also. They just like the idea of generating their own power. But there's quite a bit of work going on to reduce the costs and improve the machines, both reduce, make them more cost-efficient and less noisy. They tend to be to generate noise, and if they're in your yard, they're much closer than the bigger machines. And so there are several machines out there. There's you could go to the American Wind Energy Association website, and they have a small machine section there. The American Wind Energy Association is AWEA, www.awea.com, C-O-M.
Uh-huh.
And I'm sorry, it's www.awea.org. And they have information on small machines. There's a couple of prominent machine makers in this country. There's several that are selling small machines for homeowners. So you can buy those machines, and they work quite well, but they are a little more expensive. I quoted some numbers earlier from the very large turbines at 4 to 5 cents a kilowatt hour. These are more like 10 cents a kilowatt hour. So you have to be in a good windy location and have high enough power demand or high enough power rates that would make economic sense.
Does the cost of the machine also include installation, so somebody would hook it up to?
You can get it installed. I don't know about the costs on those, but typically people install their own. They're enthusiasts.
not just dumb people who want to.
There are people that have a business of installing them for you, so you can get that done. I don't know anything about the costs for that.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
All right,
okay.
Well, thank you. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Again, our guest is Robert Thresher. He's the director of the National Wind Technology Division of the National Renewable Energy Lab in Golden, Colorado. We're talking about wind energy, and questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. I think that we have now touched on the three, when one reads about wind power, you read about people's concerns and the things that they find to object to. We have touched on all of them now. That is, some people think the turbines are unattractive. Some people are concerned that while they may not produce air pollution, that they produce noise pollution. So there's a noise thing they're concerned about. And they're concerned about the impact on wildlife and birds, is what we're talking about. People are really concerned that birds are going to fly into them and be killed. You said it in response to an earlier caller that chances are that if you had one of these turbines on your property, say you were going to do that, that the birds would be smart enough, if it was visible enough and open enough, they'd be smart enough to learn how to go, to know how to go around it. It seems that maybe we're having a bigger issue if we're talking about a big wind farm, although maybe the general may still apply, and you would do your best, I would hope, not to locate it in a major flyway where there would be a lot of birds. Is there anything else that, though, we can do other than simply relying on the birds to be smart enough not to fly into them? Anything that people are thinking about to try to just make sure that that's not going to happen?
Yes, that's been a – I'm glad you brought that up again. There has been quite a bit of publicity concerning a wind farm in particular in California that was one of the very first wind farms put in the 1980s, and it's gotten quite a bit of bad publicity because it's killed a lot of raptors over the years. So there's been a tremendous amount of research. I've been involved in it, and this laboratory's funded research to look at the problem and see what was going on. And basically what we found out is that wind farm was sited in the middle of
a very large population, local population of raptors. So the first principle is and everybody does this now, is to do a survey to look for the wildlife in the area, what birds are there, and to look at it in a number of different seasons, summer, winter, fall, and spring, to get an idea of what birds are using the area and whether or not they might be in danger. And so you avoid high concentrations of birds, local populations. You want to avoid flyways and areas where birds might congregate, some feeding area, something of that nature. And the wildlife biologists in the local area typically know that. And so most wind farm operators will commission a review, an environmental review that includes avian issues, and they'll look for that. And if they think there's going to be a problem, they will walk away from that site because of the avian issue. So the first principle is don't site them where there's a high concentration of birds. We found that other wind plants that are not located in high concentration areas kill very few birds. Probably your car, you kill more per year with your car than even the big wind turbines do. Another thing that's happened is the turbines have gotten bigger. The rotor speed is dramatically slowed down so that they don't turn as fast, so that they're much more visible, and there's more open space. So there's a longer period of time for the bird to actually fly through the rotor and get through safely than with the smaller high-speed turbines. So that's made them better. We've done some research to kind of look at other issues associated with things like somehow inadvertently enhancing the prey base that might draw birds in to the area. For example, in California, one wind farm, making the roads the way they were done made it great habitat for ground squirrels, which actually drew more raptors into the area. So you've got to look at the way you do the environment on the ground so that you don't kind of create an attractive nuisance. We've also reduced perching opportunities, so birds aren't as likely to come and fly and think that the wind turbine is a tree that you put in for them to perch on, which would, again, draw them into the area. Mm-hmm. So there's been a number of steps both taken, and the turbines have been changed by design changes that slowing the rotors down has helped that, and that's been part of the technology evolution. Mm, and the big issue, though, is just a lot better sighting to avoid large populations.
We have some other callers. Let's do that. Talk to at least one or two. Next is Bloomington, line 4. Hello.
Yeah, hello. Good morning. You pretty much answered my question while I was waiting, but just another one to add. You mentioned perching. You know, what do they do to prevent that? And then, two, when they're prospective builders of these are projecting around to see, you know, the different characteristics of the land and whether it's feasible to build, who do they contact? I mean, is about the birds situation and whether it's the flyway. I know that California thing has really been a mess. So what agency then supplies that information, and would the Audubon Society be in on that and so forth? Thank you.
With regard to that information, it's really sometimes it's quite difficult to find that in one spot. So a lot of looking at the wildlife and avian issues in particular is to go to the local universities and contact them, and then to look a bit at what's in the open literature that's been published about a certain area. So a lot of it goes to local people. They would contact if there's an Audubon representative to see if
what information they might have about the local bird populations. In addition, they would contact the Fish and Wildlife Service. There are state agencies. Typically, there's a State Department of Natural Resources. So they would contact all of those folks. And there are several local and national level consulting houses that do environmental assessments. There's a number of folks that specialize in doing that for wind farms, and they kind of have a group of people that they know, and they know the local bird people, and they go to them. Sometimes they'll hire them to help with the studies. Local universities are a classic place to go to get the right information and get some people to do. Basically, they'll sit out and watch the birds and count birds and see what times they come by and what seasons and how many and what species, and they'll look at the area and the terrain, and certain species like certain habitats, so they can classify things that way. It's quite well developed in terms of doing these kinds of studies now. They've had over 10 years to get better and better. Not that we know all the answers, but they're getting good at spotting when things might be a problem.
Well, there, we're going to have to stop. We've used our time. My apologies. We have a couple of people we can't take. If you're interested, by the way, in renewable energy, there is a website for the National Renewable Energy Lab. That's www.nrel.gov, so you can go there and take a look at it. Our guest this morning is the director of the National Wind Technology Division at the National Renewable Energy Lab in Golden, Colorado, Robert Thresher. And Dr. Thresher, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Our program today, Focus 580, made possible in part by a grant from Horine's Pianos Plus, your Steinway piano showroom in Bloomington. Horine's Pianos Plus offers new and pre-owned pianos by Steinway & Sons, Boston by Steinway, and other fine pianos. The end of our fiscal year is almost here. Operating costs are increasing. Government funding is uncertain. That's why it's especially important this year's listener support goal be met and even exceeded. What you'll hear on WILL Radio in the coming year depends on it, and right now we are still about $16,000 away from the goal. Your contribution right now will get us there. Give us a call, 217-244-9455. We will take a break as we usually do this time. We'll have news, an update on the markets, then more focus, so stay tuned.